Isn't it also true that here as recently as just a few days previous to the March 19th vote that Pam Williams also made the statement at the Crow legislature at your questioning, Jay? She said, in a best case or in a perfect world, these appendages or those necessary paperwork that needed to be a part of this document were not there or prepared.
Wasn't that refreshing? Pam Williams, she, even though she's an attorney, she speaks her mind, shoots from the hip, and will tell you straight up what she's thinking. And that's essentially what she said, that in a perfect world, we would have had Appendix 1 and all the other appendices to the compact finalized before presentation to Congress and before passage by Congress, which was 180 degrees from what executive legal in that same meeting and in previous meetings was saying, which was essentially, why would you want to have this documentation? Why would you want to, why would we want to cuff ourselves, if you will? And of course, that's also reflective of some of the comments I've heard from our federal implementation team. It's pretty extraordinary that the federal implementation team, that's John Chaffin, Interior Solicitor, field office out of Billings. That's Rhonda Knudsen, a water manager with the BIA regional office out of Billings. That's Doug Davis, Bureau of Reclamation. I believe he's an engineer, and that's going to be our three musketeers. There's a fourth as well with the Department of Justice. And again, this goes back to that Bush administration policy, which is still the federal policy today, even though it's been lightly followed, and that is that all these federal implementation teams for the various Indian water settlements must include a representative from the Department of Justice. So we've got a representative from the U.S. Department of Justice as well. He's a trial attorney, and he's going to be arguing on your behalf when it comes time to go back into court. But their comments were basically that why would you want to have specificity when it comes to your water claims? Why not just make your claims when it comes to time to establish your water code? Well, that's not what the compact sets out. The compact provides that we're supposed to have an Appendix 1 within a year after the state legislature passed the compact. And again, that would have been June 22nd, 2000. And not only that, but state law, again, MCA 852-234, which is referenced in the compact, requires an extraordinary amount of specificity before a state water judge is going to approve a proposed decree. Now, if the state water judge wants to disregard state law, there's another court in Helena that would probably sting him on that issue, and that's the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court is going to probably be posed with some type of review of the state water court's decision. It seems as though there is enough contention at this point in time, and of course, it'd be premature to talk about appeals or anything of that sort because we just don't know what the proposed decree looks like. We haven't heard the arguments. We don't know where Montana's at, and a lot of that's going to become clearer as time goes on. It would be really great to have more of an understanding as in terms of the time frame, but for the listeners out there, we all want the money to come pouring in as promised by Congress. We've got some live appropriations there that are contingent on some things happening, but the main thing that has to happen is the finalization of our court proceeding before the state water court. The adjudication of our water rights go back to the 1975 federal filing, and here we are today. And it's the same claim that the state water court has before it, and this is part of the state's general stream adjudication statewide. The state's trying to tie up all of the water rights, associate them with land, and so we can move, so the state can eventually move on and start talking interstate water allocations with some of the downstream Missouri River Basin states. So we're one of the, of course, as a headwaters portion of the state of Montana, we're a key element to that. The economic viability of the reservation and the distribution of the most important resource supporting the local agricultural economy. As well as to some major degrees, the tourism economy is water, and it's an interesting chapter in the long-standing fight over Crow resources that dates back to the pre-Columbian times, probably, of the history of the Crows protecting and defending their reservation or their homeland, I guess, at the time. from outside encroachment and competing resource consumers. So here we are. It's just the latest chapter of a long-running history and a long-running story. And it's about time we got something right. We have a proud history of defending our resources up until the point we've somehow found ourselves as wards or as sitting as beneficiaries to a trustee. Things haven't been so bright when it comes to protection of core resources, but water is immensely important, as we know. It goes with the land, it's part of the land, and it makes the land productive and valuable, and it's something that the federal government can do a lot better job with the Crow tribe, and it's, of course, something the tribal leadership could do a lot better as well in advocating on behalf of the allottees. The whole intent and purpose of allotting land was to have self-sufficient Indians being able to productively and self-sufficiently live on their reservation. If we were to honor the intent and spirit of the original intent of allotting Indian lands, we'd be doing everything we possibly could to make sure that they get their fair share of water to do exactly that, live productively and self-sufficiently on their land.
Isn't kind of, well, not to beat it, but with Pam Williams, once again, when she made the statement, in a perfect world, she's also said that the federal government had filed on behalf of the tribe. There was no mention as to the individual allottee. But also she said it would be enormously cost to notify approximately 6,000 allottee Crows would be too much. So she admittedly, in words of admission, stated that she hadn't followed through as to their trust responsibility to the individual allottee. They had not been allowed to sit at the table and negotiate in any part whatsoever of the compact to their individual interest, their future benefits and so much as monies derived from or their future development of their private property in that relinquishment of their rights to and also that of the water. It was an amazing conversation to sit there in that audience and watch her admit to this, there was a lot of political statements. There was a lot of statements made superficially without great detail, as I saw you and a few others try to pursue upon a more defined meaning. And yet also you addressed the issue, I remember, as so much as the monies from the budget of the tribe to the Secretary of Interior. And he mentioned his the attorney that was there, the young man from Michigan, and that any questions would be sent towards him as to clarification on the tribe's expenditures and questions as to budget allocations, which in and of itself is another issue, because I've had people ask as to the settlement and the connection with in the Carl Vann administration as to $10 million that was, it's been told to me that it would negate the tribe from participation as to the Cabell settlement or certain other things. It's an unusual subject, too, that keeps coming up within the tribal enrollment.
Well, the only thing that I'm aware of with regards to the 2006 settlement of the case, which is styled Crow Tribe versus Norton, and that was the historic tribal trust accounting suit, somewhat analogous to the Cobell litigation. But, of course, in our context, that was for about a 20-year period of time in which the tribe was alleging historic mismanagement of the tribal trust accounts. And sued the Interior Department, specifically the Secretary. Of course, we never got to the merits before the judge because it was settled out of court, and $10 million was the settlement amount. Of course, the United States did request for, as part of the settlement, a waiver of rights to claims that the tribe would have otherwise been able to continue to pursue. I haven't had the opportunity to review the finalized order that was accepted by the D.C. District Court, the District of Columbia Federal District Court. But to my knowledge, the Cobell settlement package that was presented to Congress and signed by Obama as part of the Claims Resolution Act, congressional appropriation will include money that will go to the tribes across the country for land interest consolidation to try to help address the fractionated ownership of so many Indian lands on reservations across the country. I don't know necessarily that the Crow tribe would be carved out of that. In other words, that we wouldn't be able to receive any of that. I believe it's over $1 billion. I don't know the exact figure offhand. I want to say either $1.5 or $1.9 billion that is supposed to go to a new program that will be administered by the Secretary of the Interior for fractionated land consolidation, and it will go to the benefit of tribes, I believe, in tribal trust. So I certainly hope that the Crow tribe didn't waive its ability to participate in a program of that sort by settling our suit against the Secretary of the Interior back in 2006. Something perhaps to note is that the money that was budgeted, the $10 million, that is, and that was budgeted under tribal law by joint action resolution between the executive chairman, Van, at the time, and the Crow legislature, that there was some pretty significant amounts of money that were budgeted but not spent according to the budget. Particular notoriety, if you will, would be over $300,000 budgeted to the Absalaga Water and Wastewater Authority. If you ask the members of the AWWA Board of Directors today, if they ever got that money, they would say no, but they were told that it would be quote-unquote replenished. So someone acted contrary to the law by not appropriating that money properly to the Water and Wastewater Authority. It could be a long time coming. Maybe they'll get that money through a splash from the Crow Water Rights Settlement Appropriation, and it would be replenished, perhaps even as late as a decade after the fact. But that is a stark example of a tribal budget not being followed. So obviously the concern perhaps held by the federal government was that something similar could happen with the Water Rights Settlement Act appropriations. So that money is going to be largely held in a trust fund administered by the Office of Special Trustee in accordance with the American Indian Trust Fund Management Reform Act of 1994. Some of that money will be invested in government-sponsored entities. Secured bonds. That's the Tennessee Valley Authority. That's the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation. That's the Commodity Credit Corporation. That's even the United States Postal Service. But it's also the same source of investments that the 107th Settlement interest account is currently invested in. So it's a pretty sound option for the tribe to have accepted. We know there will always be a principal generating interest, and hopefully that will last as long as the grass grows and wind blows and, no pun intended, water flows. But that's the plan. Now, that money doesn't come again to the Crow tribe until we have finalization with the court process that needs to play itself out, and that means the time for an appeal has run of the eventual final court order from the Montana State Water Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court potentially could sit in a position of review for whatever the water court decides. Basically, long story short, it's going to be some time before that $460 million comes our way. The money that's available today is the Tribal Compact Administration account. It's one of four accounts that was established in the Crow Settlement Fund. I wish the Congress had used the term trust fund, because it is a trust fund. It would add a little bit more accuracy and understanding to what this money is to be used for and its purpose. But the Tribal Compact Administration account is $4.776 million. It's available right away to the Crow tribe. We just have to submit a tribal management plan for that money. There are strings attached. It's for the establishment of a water code as well as the establishment of a tribal water department. Hopefully it will serve, and it's supposed to last 10 years. hopefully it will serve as the foundation for the development of a professional water department that will work hand-in-hand with the LOTTEs to help them become self-sufficient. And not only that, but hopefully, I guess best-case scenario is that we not only have self-sufficient LOTTEs that no longer have to go to the lessee, but that they'll also pretty successful. I mean, we see a lot of successful farmers and ranchers on the reservation, very few of whom are tribal members. So if this if things start going our way, then we'll hopefully see a lot of improvements in this area. I mean, that's the best way to honor the original intent of why we even have allotments on the reservation and why we even have a reservation, for that matter. There's a lot of things that need to happen between now and then. I would encourage any Crow member to hold the powers that be accountable, and that starts here in Crow Agency, but also goes to Helena and Washington, D.C., Billings, anybody, or any place, anywhere, where there's anybody who has anything to say with the protection of the Crow water rights, that they need the pressure put on them. This could still turn out to be a pretty good deal if everything works in the favor of the allottees, meaning that there's full quantification that's articulated that is going to be what we would have won if we had pursued litigation. The Justice Department, I should note, a lot of people don't know that the Justice Department of the United States has a slightly different policy than the Interior Department when it comes to the quantification of water on Indian lands. The Justice Department has long pushed for a multiple perspective when it comes to the original intent of an Indian reservation, and they believe that it's a more dynamic usage of land that includes a lot of things beyond irrigation, whereas the Interior Department has a slightly different policy where it's more focused on irrigation. And if you're not irrigable, if you don't own irrigable land, it's possible you may be carved out entirely. That's what happened to some degree to the Wind River tribes in Wyoming. They argued for a diversity of uses on their reservation. The Wyoming Supreme Court said, no, your reservation was established to make you a pastoral agricultural people, so you're going to get the practically irrigable acreage standard. You're not going to get mineral uses. You're not going to get recreational uses. You're not going to get industrial uses. Of course, that's contrary to what the Department of Justice stands for, and it's contrary to what the Crow tribe should stand for. It's contrary to what the allottees believe in. I think, by and large, irrigation is good. It's nice, but it's not the only use of water on land. Our 1868 treaty says explicitly that the Crow Reservation is set aside for the exclusive use and occupation of the Crow people. Use and occupation is a pretty broad and general statement. We want to use and occupy this land and its resources how we see fit. And that includes industrial, that includes any type of water use that would benefit the Crow people. So quantifying our water with the understanding that we were just to irrigate and not consumptively use water in any other method or fashion is improper. So that kind of pressure on the Interior Department and on our tribe, I think, could pay dividends to make sure that every allottee gets a fair share and a fair shake. That pressure needs to come because we know that Holdings is not going to sit silent. We know that Padlock Ranch is not going to sit silent. We know that the other 8,000 state water claimants are not going to sit silent. They're going to hire attorneys. They're going to make their arguments in response to the objections that the United States and Crow Tribe is making before the Montana Water Court. They are going to press and fight tooth and nail for every last drop of water they're claiming. And similarly now, the allottees, in hopefully a good coalesced effort and a unified front, can put that same pressure on those who would purport to represent the best interests of the allottees.
Jay, going back to the junior of the Crow tribe, I don't know whether the state had this got a clear or in definition, but they might be going to the Bighorn Water User Commission. In their department, they were saying that the new applicant will be considered after the water users have used up the water, and they call it subordinate. How do you define that?
Well,
The state of Montana is not going to be regulating
tribal water users, and the tribe is not going to be regulating state-based water rights holders. That's the agreement between Montana and the Crow Tribe. I think most people would endorse that basic notion. If someone has made the representation to you that the state's going to have any say over your use of water, other than the ability the state would have to enforce or argue that your water use, if it be a new development of the tribal water right, that means, of course, developed post-1999, would have an adverse effect on a pre-1999 water user, then the state's going to raise that objection. And if I could, just basically the way the process is supposed to play out, according to the compact, is if you've got a post-1999 tribal water use that's being applied for by the tribe, in other words, you're wanting to get a permit from the tribe for a new appropriation of tribal water, you've got to receive a determination that your intended water use is not going to have an adverse effect on a pre-99 state-based water user. Well, who makes that determination? Well, at first instance, it's going to be the Tribal Water Rights Department. The Tribal Water Rights Department, though, doesn't have the authoritative voice on that issue. They are essentially going to make a preliminary finding, and they would have to clear it with the State Department of Natural Resources and Conservation. If the State Department of Natural Resources and Conservation says, yes, indeed, no adverse effect, things will run pretty smoothly. But in the event the state says, well, no, there is an adverse effect, that's when we start fighting a little bit. We would go before the Crow Montana Water Compact Board, one representative of the Crow Tribe as appointed by the tribal chairman, one representative from the state of Montana appointed by the state governor. And between those two, they would select the third. And there's a fairly elaborate process as to how that third member is selected. Basically, the tribal representative will pick three names. The state representative will pick three names. And then the tribal representative will zing two of the state representative selections. And likewise, the state representative will knock out two of the tribal representative's suggested names. So that leaves you with two possibilities left. Those two possibilities would go to the law school dean in Missoula, and the University of Montana School of Law dean will then select between those two names, and that'll be the third member of this panel, the Montana Crow Tribe Water Compact Board, and they are going to make a final administrative determination as to whether or not there is, in fact, an adverse effect on a pre-existing state-based water user. Whatever they decide, there's an automatic right to appeal if you want to appeal before the phantom phrase or the hollow phrase is court of competent jurisdiction. What does that mean? I don't know. But it definitely means a court sitting here in the state of Montana, whether it be tribal, federal, or state, with a what's called a de novo review, meaning a new review, a right to trial on the merits of the claim. So basically, whatever the compact board says, the court can reset everything and start anew with a de novo review of the merits of the points of contention on each side. That's essentially the process that's supposed to play out in the event that you have a tribal water use permit that is being objected to by the state. But that's their real authority there, and really their only authority when it comes to dictating which tribal members get water permitted by the Crow Tribe. The Secretary of the Interior stands in a similar position as far as protection is concerned, overseeing the administration of the Tribal Water Department, and the intent there is to protect the allottees to ensure that there's no arbitrary denial of a water permit to an allottee, that the terminology that was referenced earlier from the Dawes Allotment Act, that 25 USC, I think it's 381. I've looked at it long enough times that I've almost memorized it. So that's that just and equitable allocation the Settlement Act refers to for irrigation purposes. So the Tribal Water Code can be much stronger than that to make sure that it's not just irrigation, but it's any beneficial water use that's going to be allowed to the allottee. That's the process that is contemplated by the compact. And for anybody that doesn't know, it's probably important to note that the tribal chairman has 6 months to appoint his member to the Crow Montana Water Compact Board. That six-month time frame began on March 19th. We don't know who he has selected yet. It's probably going to be sometime in the near future when he makes the selection. But we'll see. That's going to be an important tribal representative in this whole scheme of events. And it'll be interesting to see who the chairman picks.
Do you have any ideas as to who that might be?
I have a sneaking suspicion it might be myself. No, I'm just kidding. I have no idea. Your guess is as good as mine. In fact, it's probably twice as good.
And, Jay, is there any dates and events coming up as far as Water Compact?
Well, if you were reading the compact in a bunker house or a bomb shelter and didn't hear from the players firsthand, you'd think that within 6 months we're going to have a proposed decree go to the state water court in Bozeman. According to executive legal, that's not going to happen. So that's really the only major pressing time-sensitive event that is right around the corner. The submission of the proposed decree is going to trigger the process in the state water court, and the process is going to be the entertaining of objections, the review of arguments, the acceptance of exhibits and testimony, supporting or opposing the various claims and objections. And there's a lot of them, so it's going to take some time. The state water court probably only wants to go through this once, and the state water court is going to be asked, pursuant to the terms of the compact, when it eventually does come, that proposed decree is going to be submitted with the thought that you've got the state on board, you've got the federal government on board, you've got the Crow tribe on board. So the thought is that it's not going to be a thorough and rigorous review. But as discussed earlier, we know that the state-based water users or water claimants, as is more appropriate, they're going to make their arguments. They're going to bring in their lawyers. And the allottees, I think, should likewise keep up the pressure on their end of things to make sure that all of the rights or claims for rights that are filed on the allottee's behalf are adequate, that they are properly reflective of the water that's necessary to support operation of agriculture or enough water to basically make the land productive and sustainable for the purpose of utilizing it for the benefit of the allottees. So outside of that, as far as the time frames are concerned, we've got the 6 months running on the chairman's submission of a name for the compact board. Everything is sort of contingent on the court process, so we'll have to wait and see. The development of the Tribal Water Code is also an important aspect here. We got 3 years from the date of tribal ratification to get a code enacted. Since 1975, the Secretary of the Interior has issued a moratorium on the approval of tribal water codes. You have a congressional superseding, if you will, of that moratorium. The moratorium, of course, would have only applied to select Indian tribes, that is, those who had constitutional provisions that required secretarial approval of their laws or resolutions. The Crow tribe is not in that category under our 2001 Constitution, but Congress put us back into that category for the purpose of establishing a tribal water code. But that can be viewed as a protection for the allottees because it has to pass federal muster, meaning it has to have the minimal substantive and procedural protections that are going to benefit the allottees and ensure due process is carried out. But that tribal water code is going to be developed, hopefully, in concert between the executive branch and the legislature, and hopefully the best aspects of both branch will prevail. The chairman has established a tribal water implementation team comprised largely of former Crow legislators, and they just had a meeting this week with the Crow Tribal Legislative Natural Resources Committee, and it was sort of a kickoff meeting, if you will, for future efforts at hashing out a code, hopefully to make something that is going to be looked at by other tribes across the country as something of a model code or as something of a code that would be adopted or followed by other tribes in terms of guidance or a language that strikes the balance between adequate tribal control, as well as the ability for Alatis to be confident that due process is going to prevail, that there's not going to be any politics played when it comes to the issuance of tribal water permits, and to ensure that everyone gets a fair share of the water that they have a legal entitlement to.
Why did the Alatis, who filed a water claim prior to June 22, 1999, receive an objection from the tribe? And why does the letter they received say they may be in violation of Section 2?
Well, I haven't seen the notice, but I have seen reserved water rights claimants in the Appendix 3 to the compact, as well as the preliminary decrees on the Prior Creek Basin, as well as the Little Bighorn River Basin, both of which came out early of last year from the State Water Court. It sounds like there's a generic form objection that's been sent by the Crow Tribal Executive Branch to all of the state claimants. Again, that Appendix 3 has about 8,000 claims, roughly. So it, instead of going through the rigor of examining each claim and the merits behind the claim, it looks like there's simply been a blanket objection, more or less. I know that the tribe was interested in doing just that, filing a blanket objection, incorporating every single claim through a single objection, but since that wasn't acceptable under state law, they had to file objections as to each one of these claims. The fact that there's reference to Section 2 of the 1920 Crow Act, and the fact that there's an objection made specifically to a reserved water rights claimant, that tells me that it's probably a generic form that was just sent essentially as almost a mass mailing to every one of those water claimants. But I honestly don't know how the state water court is going to treat the allottees who did file during the time when the filing period was open. And I think that period of time, there was two filing periods to my knowledge, the most recent of which was in the early 1990s. So it's been at that point in time, of course, there was no water compact, and I don't know if there was any thought that there would be one in the near future. So you've got some tribal members that filed their claims with the state adjudication process, perhaps thinking that that was the way to secure their water use at the time. And whatever the case, it's not clear how the state water court's going to treat their claims. It's possible they may be discharged entirely from being considered as a state-based water use and basically put into the category of tribal water uses under Appendix 1, the proposed decree. Those are the types of issues that are going to be hashed out in the state water court so that we get something that's actually reflective of the intent of the compact, as well as reflective of federal and state law, instead of the mixing and mingling that we sort of see going on right now. But it's interesting, isn't it, that with all those thousands of claims that somehow in the shuffle, some tribal members out there have received objections from the tribe on the basis of Section 2. Kind of puzzling in a way, but I guess that's the process that we're, the reality of the situation is, maybe Pam Williams said it best, it's not a perfect world. So that's the playground that we're working on right now.
I believe, though, truly that if it was a truth in fact forum, a presentation made to the Crows within the districts and within the various buildings, if it was a truth to fact forum with definitions of the compact and of the settlement brought before the Crow people within a period of time to digest, that this never would have passed. Never would have. Until such time as it was understood and the benefits to the tribal and the individual Crow were met. But I'd like to thank Jay for being here, and also I appreciate that and his endeavors to, which I see is pursuing his name. He has truly prayed on the mountain, and we have listened to him. We have listened to him. We appreciate him. We hope to invite him back because...
Well, I'd love to come
back.
We enjoy
our people and hearing about them and informing them, and we need more people as Jay. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. It's an honor.
Are there any other final questions? Legislature Law Clerk for the Crow Tribe and Mr. Patrick Hill, Nalati. Thank you. Aho.
Ichilu.